on the end of the other side of this tape I was talking about, going to accept the job, but I had told people I'd accept the job at Foul Furious, the Gloria Corporation, on May the 1st. So I finished out the month of April of 1941 with a place in the valley, and immediately morning of May the 1st, we packed up and left the valley, left Edinburgh, and went to Foul Furious, found a place to stay, live, furnished, little furnished house, and I went out to the plant, and they were wanting to get some gas into the laboratory and office of the plant. And again, the whole trouble was the regulator that I took out. I knew there was something wrong with the regulator. I took it out, and there was a red pocket handkerchief, bandana handkerchief that some fellow had left the line sometime and had got into the regulator, and gas couldn't come in there. I began to spend all my time then studying what was built, what was to be done, how it worked. Went over and over and over and over the flow sheet till I could have drawn it in my sleep. And on the 21st day of May, we started up. I started the first engine to start moving gas through the place and back into the reservoir for the residue. We didn't quite have the distillation and fractionation units going yet, so we run on what we call natural separation, and 1,500 pounds per square inch, which was dropping it down to 1,500 pounds per square inch. And natural separation go out, and we had to compress it back to about 3,000 pounds to get it back into formation from which we were cycling. On the 4th of July, we started the distillation and fractionating units up. We ran 5 days, and one of our oil heaters burned down. So we had to back off from the distillation and fractionating units for about 2 weeks while we rebuilt the oil heater. Had a comparatively older fella on the gate watching the watchman. When that heater burst the tube and started burning, of course there was a big black smoke rolling up, and the sheriff of the county came out, asked his watchman, says, "You need anybody help keep people out?" And the watchman, "No, sheriff," says, "might need some help keeping some that should be in there, but I don't know, there's anybody wanting to go in." After getting the heater repaired, we started the units up again. We were running about half capacity, and everything was working fine. So we decided to go to full capacity. We went to full capacity, and then things began to show up. I had somewhat anticipated them, that what was going to happen was going to happen, but I hadn't been able to convince anybody, but our depropanizer column would not handle but half the load that we wanted to go through it. Just almost exactly half of it. And we had a contract with a company to sell them isobutane, and which was making 100 octane gasoline for aircraft. Some of it was going to England and France at the time at war with Germany, and we couldn't make the product running full load on without the propanizer. Construction company had us try a number of things, and I kept telling them, I don't care what you do, you can't make that column bigger. And that's the only thing that can be done, is to make it bigger. So, the full load just won't go through it. So, finally, Mr. Wilson called the construction people and told them he wanted to meet all of them down there at that plant. We all got in there, and I mean, he was a very soft, but Mr. Wilson was a very soft-spoken man, and he didn't get his frustration or whatever you wanted to call it out much, but he did then, and he started to ask them what they could do to, we could get that plant on full production in within 48 hours. They said it couldn't be done. He just went around all those construction men, and then he started in on all of us there at the plant. I was the tail end of it. And I had to figured out what to say, what we could do. So he got to me and he said, what can you do? And I said, we can, I told him what I thought we could do to do it. He says, he turned to these construction people and he says, all right, let's be doing it by tomorrow, noon. They was kind of abashed, but they got the stuff that I needed, and we did it. Started up full load, put the column on, put the columns on the line, and boy, we was making. He'd sent me in, told me to come back at 4 o'clock the next morning when they thought they might have it ready. And at 8 o'clock, I got a sample of our isobutane, which had to be 98.9% pure. And took it into the laboratory, and the fella put it on the machine and tested it. I knew it was all right. He put it on that machine and run an analysis and come out to be a little better than 99% pure. And Mr. Wilson made me stand right there with him while I was watching this fellow run the thing. When he told us that it's good isobutane, he turned to me and he says, okay, your pay is up $25 a month as of the first of this month. So I never worked for a finer man in my life than Mr. Wilson, and his and the vice president of the company, and Mr. Will. They were just absolutely the best people in the world. The way we were running was makeshift, of course, that we could do in a hurry when we had to, and rather inefficient. We had, Mr. Wilson told the engineering company that was doing construction, told them to figure out what we needed to do some changing, and we was going to add on two more engines and increase the throughput some, and get what we needed to do the job right. So they, after a couple of months, they submitted their proposal, and Mr. Wilson gave it to me, and he says, go over this carefully with a fine-tooth comb, and I think you could cut some off, maybe $20,000 or $30,000 off of this. So I started going over to the fine-tooth comb, as he said, and came up with what I figured was a figure of about cut off around 23,000, and maybe some more. And I told just exactly how I would do it. Wrote him a report just exactly how I would do that cutting off. All that, he said, I give it to him, and he looked at it. He says, okay, I'm going to take this to Hudson and tell them that's the way we're going to do it. If they argue, I'm going to take you in with me to back me up. So he took it to Hudson and gave it to the man. And the contractor it was, Hudson Engineering Company was a contractor. And he took it to them and told them, they looked at it and said they just didn't see how to cut that much off. And he says, well, my man Homer Gibbons says it can be done. And so that's the way we're going to do it. And if you don't like it, why, we'll do it ourselves. So they decided they could do it. And one of the construction company men that came down one time, he was a process designer and so on. He says, how'd you know that that all could be done? Well, I said, I haven't been in this business for 25 years not to know what can be and what can't be done. He says, 25 years experience? I says, yes. He says, why didn't you tell us that you had all that experience when you were over here applying for a job with us a couple of years ago? I says, you didn't ask me. He says, well, maybe so. He says, just looking at you, I thought probably maybe you'd had 5 to 6, 7 years of experience. As your looks at deceives your age, I guess. I said, yeah, I've had a little trouble with that before. After the job was finished and all paid for, it came up to the point where we'd actually saved $31,000, or I'd actually trimmed it down $31,000 from a $110,000 deal to $79,000. And hardly believe it. Mr. Wilson says that's another $50 a month raise in pay for you. So you can begin to see why I thought he was one of the finest men I ever worked for. He told us one time, just after we got the plant going good, he says, of course, now I'm liable for all the money in this thing. He said, it's going to make money. He said, I'm liable for all of it that's in here. And so he says, I'm going to get a big share of it. But he says, you folks are going to get your share, too. Up to this time, all pumping of the propane, isobutane, normal butane, all that had been done by reciprocating piston pumps. But volumes were so great in our case that centrifugals had to be used. But there wasn't any, and the centrifugal pump shafts had to be packed. There's no way, any way out to get around it. I kept on to the, jumping on to the packing people. Finally, one of them developed a seal. Instead of using package, used a carbon seal running on the stellite face. And that worked real well. But we had a lot of trouble with packing until we got that. We'd have to seal the packing to seal off the butane and the propane leaking out. Through packing, we'd have to put a what we call the lantern ring in the middle of the packing and run the seal oil in there. And there's an awful narrow range there where if you got it just a little too much oil, a little too much pressure, it'd go into the product. It didn't get quite enough. The product would force it out and it'd freeze it up. So it was a complete mess. After a lot of experimentation on our pumps by a couple of packing companies, there was finally a seal developed that worked fine. And they wasn't but a few more years that the all companies supplied pumps, seals on their pumps when you bought them. And but the development of the seal was the really the reason that LPGs, liquefied petroleum gas, could be pumped with centrifugal pumps without any trouble of leakage one way or the other. If the seal started leaking a small amount, warm water could be put to the into the packing gland and held at a pressure somewhat below the discharge pressure of the pump. You could vaporize it and it wouldn't freeze up. And as I say, the development of the seal was a great boon to the LPG pumping industry by centrifugal pumps. While we were still using packing in those pumps and using the seal oil in there, there was a queer thing kind of happened that shouldn't happen in any place. We had one fellow that was the maintenance foreman in the plant. He was on the exact same salary scale and supervisor that I was. And operators in the plant kept telling me that things that he was doing to get him in trouble. And as I couldn't complain to anybody about it, he was on my same level, and I didn't want to cause any stir. He'd never done anything that reflected on me. Finally, one day, I was in our pump house, which was on two levels, and I was on the lower level getting information off of a big water pump that I needed to know about. And he slipped into the pump house there, and he couldn't see me, but I could see him through a opening through one of the pump packing spaces. And he came in, he looked all around, and he didn't see an operator or a helper or anybody like that. So he slipped over and shut the seal oil off on the propane pump that was running, turned around and beat it out right quick. I run over and got the seal oil established on it again. And by the time I got it fixed up again, the operator come in, and I told him what had happened. He says, "What you gonna do?" I said, "Well, I don't know for sure yet. And I'll go back to the office, and I'm gonna sit there at my desk and see if I can study out what I should do about that." And he said, he says there was some of our fellows went into Corpus Christi at the office yesterday and complained about things he was doing to upset us all. And so if you need any backing up, we'll back you up, because they're already investigating that. I went in and the office, and I sit down at my desk. I was trying to figure what I should do when he walked into the superintendent's office and said, "Well, goddamn operators have fooled things again. They've upset the seal oil on the propane reflux pump, and it's all shot to hell." And the superintendent says, "Well, why? What happened?" He says, "Well, got the spare on." So the superintendent called me and he said, "We go out and look." So I went out there and I walked in, and there the pump was running, not the spare, but the regular pump was running. And he says, "I just can't understand it. It was all leaking and freezing up here a while ago." And I didn't say anything. It was obviously it was running all right. Operator was there too. And of course he knew what we were looking at. This fella, he didn't think that the operator knew anything about it. But he still couldn't figure how in the world that seal oil got back on that pump so quick, because it only took a matter of a minute or two without the seal oil. It would freeze up and stop the pump working. The next day, the vice president of operations of the company came down. The superintendent of the plant lived there next to the plant in the company house, as did this fellow. I lived in town, so this vice president came in the morning, and he And he walked over where I was sitting at my desk doing some figuring. He says, you're going to lunch with me today. I said, okay. Always before, he hadn't come in and said it that way. He said, can you go to lunch with me today? And I said, yes. So that time I said, yes, sir. Come noontime, he came in and we went and got in his car and started in town to the cafe. And he says, you know, those fellows came from here yesterday, up, or day before yesterday, up to my office. He said, we had a little set-to in Mr. Wilson's office, and that they are complaining about this fellow. It was the maintenance, head of the maintenance department, and said they're complaining about things he's doing. He said, do you know anything for sure that he's done? I says, yes. I said, yesterday, I was in the pump house and was down behind the pump getting information off of it, and I saw him come in, look around, not seeing the operator anyway, he run and he went and shut the seal oil off on that propane pump and immediately beat it out of the pump room down to the engine room. I said, I run over and got the seal oil back established before anything happened. Got the operator and told him what had happened and to watch it. I said, then I went back to my desk in the office and with the information I'd got off of this other pump and was done figuring on it, and he came into the superintendent's office and said that, told him that the operators had let the seal oil got off on that pump and frozen it up, maybe ruined the shaft, and had to get the spare pump running. The superintendent said, okay, let's go look. That he asked me to go along. We went and looked, and sure enough, the pump was running as beautiful as could be. He couldn't understand it at all. And he says, he really got upset. He stopped his car, and he said, what were you going to do? I said, well, I didn't know just what I could do. I said, he was on the same level as I was and everything. I just didn't know what I could do. And I said, I just about decided that I was going to tell you the next time you came down, because I had heard then about the, by that time I'd heard about the fellows being in, kicking at to you in your office. He swore like a Missouri mule skinner and said he ought to go back and fire that fella. Said he'd come down to tell him he'd accept his resignation if he wanted to turn it in. And if he didn't, why, he was out anyway. He says, I shouldn't even let him have the chance of submitting his resignation. He said, anybody that do a thing like that shouldn't have a job in a place like this, particularly as a foreman. And he says, I'll see. I says, I already told him this morning that I'd accept his resignation if he wanted to turn it in. And says, I'll tell you, see if this afternoon if he wants to, and if he don't, he says, I'll just tell him he's fired outright. Well, the fellow had kind of, I think, figured out that some way I'd got the wind of the pump had been fixed up some way before it went bad, and he didn't know whether anybody had seen him or not, but he figured out that I knew about it, the way I acted when we went out there. And so he decided that the best thing he'll do is to submit his resignation, which he did. Things went quite smoothly after that. This episode happened in August of 1941, and we'd been running about 5 months at that time, and the superintendent had to be gone as his mother was sick and thought dying, and whenever he was gone, this vice president of operations or one of his helpers in the office would come down and be acting superintendent. So after that, whenever the superintendent had to be gone, this vice president of operations says, from now on, whenever the superintendent's gone, you're going to be the acting superintendent till he gets back. Not long after that decision was made, the superintendent had to leave, and his mother did die, and he had to go to the funeral. So we'd had a fella come in and work there that had been released from the Army because he was a little over age and had a family, supposedly. And we'd got word from the commanding officer where he'd been released from, that he didn't, for any reason, he left the job, or we laid him off, that we'd notify this commanding officer within 48 hours. So while the superintendent was gone on to his mother's funeral, this fella pulled a deal that I just couldn't tolerate. I laid him off. And he said I couldn't lay him off because I wasn't the superintendent and hadn't hired him. Well, I says, you aren't working until the superintendent gets back then. I talked to this vice president of operations, and he says, you did the right thing. He said, we'll pay him off. And he said, if he won't take his check till the superintendent gets back, why, just hold it until he does get back. And so I got his check and gave him up to the day that he'd worked. And I wired his former commanding officer that we had to lay him off. And I got a telegram back from the commanding officer then. He said, what do you think we let him go for? Says, I don't want him either. Superintendent got back, and 2 days later, and I filled him in. He says, give me the check and I'll take it and see that he takes it. Says, you laid him off, and the vice president of operations said to lay him off. Boy, he's laid off. So he took the check, went and gave it to the fellow, and He said he started arguing. I told him why he was laid off and things that he'd done we couldn't tolerate being done anymore. So that was the last that we had put up with him. Things went along pretty good shape after that until sometime in 43, I believe it was, when Dorothy's father passed away, and she was coming back, and I was going to meet her up at the San Antonio. She was coming to San Antonio by train. I had enough gasoline stamps, I could go up there and meet her. So I got up there when the train was due in at, I think it was 6 o'clock in the morning. I went into the station and it was listed to be 6 hours late. So I had 6 hours to kill around there. I decided to go out to the Sam Houston Army place and see if I could get back on active duty. I went in and told the sergeant what I wanted. He told me to go to a certain door. I walked in there. There was the old doctor that had run me out when I was in Tulsa. He says, "What do you want?" I told him, "I'll see if I can get back on active duty." He says, "What are you doing?" I told him where I was and what I was doing, making training aviation gasoline and isobutane to make 100 octane aviation gasoline. He says, "Well, you get back down there and keep making that stuff until they start coming across the Rio Grande River, and then we'll give you a gun and let you sign you up into the Army again." So that was the end of me ever getting into the Army. In fact, they had my draft card, draft sign up so well hidden nobody could find it up in Tulsa. When I wanted to make a trip to the interior of Mexico, they couldn't find it to give me a permission, so they just give me a permission anyway. Later they found my draft card in the, way back in the back of the inactive file. Along about this time also, I started getting letters or forms from the engineering science and management programs sign-up deal that was taking care of all scientific and engineering help, keeping track of it, getting them assigned, and they wanting me to, these was coming, I'd sign up, and not long after I'd send that in, I would get a request from the Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi to write a report to what I was doing, making their aviation training gasoline and isobutane to make the 100 octane. I'd write that report, give it to them. I'd never hear anything more about it till maybe 6-8 months later. I'd get another one of those forms from the engineering science and technical managing concern association or listing, whatever they, however they called it, don't remember right now. and fill that out and send it in. And again, in very short order, I'd get another request from the Navy and the Corpus Christi station, Naval Air Station, to write the report. So I'd write the report, give it to the Naval, and I wouldn't hear anything more. Some maybe a year or go by before I'd get another one from the Scientific Engineering and Technical Committee deal. And answered it again. And then a few months after the war was over, man that I knew, a salesman for a pump company, and he traveled out of Corpus Christi, came in and with another man that he said was the vice president of his company in Houston, and introduced me to him. And this fellow said, "Oh, Homer Gibbons, South Darius." "Oh, yeah." He says, "I remember you now." He says, "I was in the Navy office in Washington during the war." He said, "And the aviation department." He says, "I did all my flying on a desk there in the Pentagon." And so he says, "You apparently had a cousin or somebody that knew you real well that was in the Manhattan district," which we would had learned then that was the outfit that made the atomic bomb. And he said, "This relation of yours was trying to get you into his department in the Manhattan district, but he never did." He said, "I'd come to my desk from the Naval Air Station here in Corpus Christi, and I'd review it and say that you shouldn't be moved, and send it on to the Secretary of the Navy, and he'd just look it over and say the same thing, and send it on to the president, and the president would uphold us." Apparently, by making your reports for the Navy, and they added their stuff to it, it overruled anything about you going to the Manhattan District. Another amusing incident happened during the war there. We had hired a young fellow who was the son of a doctor in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he was what we would term a number one first class, without equivocation, screwball of the worst kind. He didn't want to do anything the way we did it. He was always late for work, late coming on duty. Finally, the draft board got after him to report, and he just disappeared. We didn't know that he'd got word from the draft board that he hadn't told us, and he just pulled up stakes, didn't even wait to get a few dollars he had coming, and just disappeared.